Okay, there have been some questions waiting to be answered. Mike? No, he's not trying to be at the crossroads. He's trying to show why you can't have any speculative metaphysical knowledge. You can't have any cognitive assurance about God's existence, the existence of the self, or the world of things in themselves. That is beyond what our concepts can deal with. And yet we're forced to use concepts in that area to regulate and organize our worldview. Will? Will, by definition, a noumena cannot be a phenomena. A noumena is something which is not part of perception, not part of appearance.
When
you say spiritual, you're trying to give me metaphysical information about them. Noumena doesn't have to be spiritual. Noumena is also the object of external world, the world of external objects.
Yep.
The world of external objects, things in themselves, we don't know. They're noumena, but they're not spiritual. I mean, not in the way that you're trying to use the word spiritual. The point is, you can only know what the mind can help you know, and the mind can't help you know about things that are beyond perception. So it can't tell you about a self, a world of things in itself, in themselves, or God. It can only give you these organizing principles of a worldview. Okay, this is the heart of Kant's major revolutionary accomplishment in the history of philosophy. The mind is active, the Copernican revolution, and therefore it is not a tabula rasa, a passive piece of paper just receiving sensation. It is a processing program that works upon that. Consequently, everything we know is not based entirely in perception. If you left things at the level of perception, it'd be blind. On the other hand, you can't just go to concepts without perceptions, because then they'd be empty. So Kant says the mind actively programs or constructs the objects of experience and makes them intelligible. It applies time and space, and then it applies these other 12 concepts such as causation, and that is the source of our knowledge. But our knowledge cannot take cognitive knowledge. Our cognitive knowledge cannot go beyond the realm of perception, cannot push into metaphysical abstractions like self, world, and God. That's at best a dialectical realm where equally persuasive answers could be given, so you have to use them just as a limiting concept, as if there was a self, as if there was a world of external objects, as if there were a God. Will?
Did he ever say why the mind does this, or why the mind pushes you on this dialectic?
Well, the mind is creative and active, and there are these concepts that are part of the programming of the mind, and it's kind of like a guy who gets a computer and tries to make the computer do things which the program can't handle. He can imagine what it would be like. I wish I could come up with a computer analogy right away. But anyway, it's like the mind can speculate about cause and cause of cause and first cause of all causes. But you see, we've just been cut free from perception. The mind, because causation is something that's part of the programming of the mind, it can think about that, but it can't think fruitfully about it if it gets beyond what we perceive. And that's why you can't prove God's existence or the self's existence, things of that nature. Now, I have two criticisms. You say, only two? Well, once you hear what the two are, we won't need many more. Remember, I've already given you my first, and I think, devastating criticism in passing. So these amount to criticisms two and three. The first one was this. Hume answers... Kant answers Hume. Now I've got it right. Kant answers Hume by what? by repeating, in a sense, what Hume said. If Hume made causation something that's just part of the mind, Kant says, okay, no problem. I can rescue causation. It's just part of the mind's programming. And I believe that shows that he has not answered Hume at all. He's just gone down a different path of philosophy now. But secondly, look at this complicated structure I have up here on the board. The transcendental aesthetic dealing with percepts, the transcendental analytic dealing with concepts, the transcendental dialectic dealing with these regulative notions of self, world, and God. That's all very complicated, I would think. And now here's the question. On what basis does Kant assume this internal programming to be universal? That is to say, how does Kant know that every human mind works this way? Works with the time-space categories and the 12 concepts of understanding. How could Kant know that? You see, he has psychologized philosophy. And the problem is, when you psychologize philosophy, is that you have no way of being sure that the person you're talking to has a mind that works like yours. Now, I'm not confident that Kant has proven that his own mind works this way, but let's just, you know, give him an easy day on that one. Even assuming that that's true about Kant's mind, how does Kant know my mind works that way? On what basis does he project this active, constructive mind on me or others? But of course, if he can't be assured of the universality of his categories, the universality of the way the mind works, that he hasn't saved philosophy or truth at all. There can't even be communication between one another. And then thirdly, to bring both of these first two criticisms together, what we have in Kant is the loss of objective public knowledge. The loss of objective public knowledge. Sure, he saved science. But the science he saved, the rationality he saved, is not something that's objective. It's psychological. It's internal. There's no assurance that it's universal, so it's not public. The things that Kant feels he can know for sure, only because the mind actively forces him to think that way, are not matters of objective public truth. And that's why philosophy, you see, has lost confidence in reason. The reason that Kant has saved is not reason as traditionally understood, giving us objective certainty about the real world that anybody publicly could know. It's just the certainty that comes from a mind that forces you to think in certain patterns or with certain categories. And so Kant has not saved science. He psychologized it. And therefore, public, objective knowledge has been lost. And what we do is we kind of bolster our feelings by saying, oh yes, but everyone must think this way, so why worry about any other possibilities? The certainty is in the certainty of the mind's working. But then we can't be certain that all minds work the same way, can we? After we take a brief break, we'll come back and look at Kant's ethic. When we turn to Kant's ethic, we think of two works in particular, his Critique of Practical Reason and his Groundwork of the Metaphysic of Morals, both of which I mentioned to you already. The Metaphysic of Morals, 1785, the Critique of Practical Reason, 1788. Kant said, we are aware of a moral law within. We are aware of a moral law within us. From what I've told you, can this awareness be a cognitive awareness, though, of the moral law? Can't be cognitive because it's not based upon percepts, right? It's part of the self that I know, but I know the self not in a cognitive way. Nevertheless, I can think rationally about what this pure... I can think about... how do I want to put this? I can consider the pure reason that would apply to such a moral law within. And I'm just going to summarize some of the high points of Kant's ethic rather than trying to work out how he gets from one point to another. But here are things you need to remember about his ethic. First, Kant says the only thing in the world which is completely good, the only thing which is completely good is a good will. A good will. Is helping an old lady across the street good? Well, provisionally so. What if we're helping an old lady across the street because we're running for president and we want to get a nice sound bite and a public relations picture that helps us get elected? Well, then it's not purely good, is it? Are hot fudge sundaes good? Well, they are, unless you happen to be a diabetic like Dr. Bonson, in which case they aren't. So you can't say that it's completely good. The only thing that's completely good, according to Kant, is a good will, doing things for the right reason, having the right intentions. And so we have to consider the motive for obeying this inner law, this inner moral law. Whatever that motive is, if it's a good will, according to Kant, it must be dissociated from any natural and empirically conditioned interest. Ethics is not dealing with natural facts, not dealing with that which is empirically conditioned by experience. It's not dealing with my desires or the consequences that I'd like to see result. Motive has nothing to do with natural interest, then. When I follow the moral law, the motive that shows my goodwill, the motive cannot be my feelings, my inclinations, expediency, or desired consequence. You know, sometimes you do the right thing, Kant points out, because it's the easiest thing to do. It's expedient. Think of a child who decides to obey his father, or a teenager, let's say, who's going to obey his father and come home before curfew, not because his heart's in it, but because it's just not convenient to have to argue with dad. Is he doing it out of a proper motive? Does he show a good will? Kant says no. Again, think of the person who is charitable, but is charitable only for the sake of having a good reputation and everybody praises him. Is that doing, you know, something out of a good will? Well, then, what is this motive if it's not tied to feelings, expediency, my inclination, or my desired consequences? Kant says, I must do my duty for duty's sake. The goodwill is the one that does its duty, but not out of inclination, not out of ulterior motive, but does its duty because it is its duty. Or as we say, duty for duty's sake. And thus Kant is a supreme example in the history of thought of what's called a deontological ethic. Deontological, deontological. If I ask you to expound on the deontological character of Kant's ethic, you'll know that I'm asking you to explain the ethic of duty, the ethic of norms. All right, duty for duty's sake. The test of a good will is not in the outcome of what is willed, but in the intention of what is willed, and the intention must be to do duty because it's duty. And so let me ask you this. Has somebody followed the moral law if they obey the Ten Commandments because they don't want to go to hell? Not according to Kant. Kant said that's self-interest. You're just, you know, watching out for your own skin. Someone has only followed the moral law if they keep the Ten Commandments. Of course, he doesn't believe in the Ten Commandments being authoritative, but we'll get to that in a minute. Only if you follow the Ten Commandments because it's the right thing to do. Not because it's going to get you ahead in life, not because it's going to avoid hellfire, but because it's right. You do what's right because it's right. You do duty for the sake of duty. Now, a quick criticism of this. We would be, I think, somewhat inclined to agree with Kant because the Bible, for instance, condemns the Pharisees who did good things so that it might be seen of men. So we realize that ulterior motives and mere inclination or expediency are not the proper motives for what we're to do. But that doesn't mean that duty is its own motive, duty for duty's sake. We would say we do our duty for the glory of God. Okay? To glorify God, I do what is right, if I'm doing it out of a pure motive. When Kant says you do duty for duty's sake, in a sense, you've got two duties that we're talking about. You can see it in the sentence when you write it down. You do your duty for duty's sake. So there is the first duty. Let's say it's the duty of not stealing or not lying. And why do I do that duty? I have the duty to do it for duty's sake, don't I? And so we have duty number two, the duty to follow duty number one for the sake of duty number one. And so we can ask Kant, why should I do duty number two? That is, why should I follow duty for duty's sake? He says it's my duty to do so, so I have to ask him, why should I do that? Should I do duty for duty's sake? For duty's sake? The answer has to be, well, yes. The duty to do your duty for duty's sake must itself be pursued for duty's sake. So that means I have a duty to do my duty for duty's sake. But what's the source of that duty, to do my duty for duty's sake? Well, it must be for duty's sake. And so I have a duty to do my duty to do my duty for duty's sake. But then, of course, there's another question, and that's going to lead us to doing duty for duty for duty for duty's sake, which is why we think of Kant's ethic as an ethic of duty, duty, do. Will, I didn't call on you, but I guess I will. Yes, Will. What is it? I wish I hadn't called on you, Will. Anyway, duty for duty's sake. Let's move on. Well, what is my duty? What is the formula so that I can rationally determine what my duty is? And this is given by Kant as the categorical imperative. An imperative, of course, is the calling on you to do something, laying an obligation on you. And Kant says we need to seek a categorical imperative. A categorical imperative stands over against a hypothetical imperative. A hypothetical imperative is like this. I give you the imperative, make sure you finish your final exam. But implicitly, that imperative is hypothetical, right? It goes like this, really, if I write it out. If you want to pass this class, finish your final exam. It's not as though there's a universal duty for everyone to do this final exam. It's if you want to accomplish this end, then finish your final exam. So that is not an imperative of morality. That's an imperative of utility, right? Or convenience, looking for a certain result or outcome. The categorical imperative is not hypothetical. It's not qualified or conditioned by anything. And what is the categorical imperative? Write this down. Quote, act only on that maxim which you can at the same time will to become a universal law. Act only on that maxim which you can at the same time will to become a universal law. According to Kant, your moral duty is to follow the maxim which can be universalized. Okay. So let's take a possible maxim. You shall not lie. Now, is that a categorical imperative? Well, can we universalize that without absurdity? What if everybody were to be honest and not to tell lies? Could we universalize that? Yeah, we wouldn't have any problem doing that. You could will it to be a universal law, and therefore, if it could be universalized, you should keep it yourself. Don't you lie, because you could say no one should lie. But let's look at the opposite. What if we were to take as our test case, what if I have as a maxim, Greg, tell a lie in this particular situation? Now, could I universalize that? Could I act on that and at the same time will it to be a universal law? Okay? I'm trying to get my way and trying to persuade somebody of something, and I decide, hey, I'll lie to them. But now what happens if it's a universal law that people can lie? Then instead of persuading the person, that person could lie back to me. Oh, yeah, I think you're right. Oh, yeah. You make a good point, Dr. Bonson. But then you see the absurdity that I've created. If everybody can lie, if I persuade you with lies, then your persuasion, your statement of persuasion could be a lie. So that would be absurd. Kant says you can't universalize lying then as a maxim of life. The only moral laws that you have then are categorical imperatives, those which you can will to become a universal law. Kind of like the golden rule, you know. Treat others as you'd have them treat yourself. Don't make any special exceptions. You need to, if this is a law of morality, it applies to you just like it applies to everybody. It must be universalizable if it's a moral law. Well, I have two criticisms of this formula for discovering our duty. First of all, notice this is not a source of moral duties. It's only a test of moral duties. It may be that every possibility that is proposed can be tested in the way that Kant says. I'm not claiming that it can, but even if it works only as a test of proposals. It doesn't give us our proposals for morality. That is, it's not a source of moral maxims. It's only a test of moral maxims that someone might propose. To put it in the philosophical jargon, this is a necessary but not a sufficient condition of a moral law. It may be necessary that any moral law is universalizable, but that's not a sufficient principle for telling us what the moral law is. Or I can express the criticism in another way. Kant has offered us only a formal feature of a moral law. He has not told us what the moral law is. He's given us the form, not the substance of the moral law. My second criticism is this. It's only too easy to get around the categorical imperative if you'll cleverly word the maxim that you're testing. Okay, let's go back. Let's deal with stealing. Now, Kant would say, if you try to universalize the maxim of stealing, you'll find that you can't do that. You create absurdities. All right, but how about this maxim? What if I don't talk about everyone stealing? What if I use as a maxim the person with the following fingerprints, and then I give the characteristics of my fingerprints. The person with the following fingerprints may steal. Kant, that's a maxim. Now, is that a categorical imperative? Can I universalize that without absurdity? Well, guess what? I can. You know why? Because if everybody